This is a tweet from at knowabout underscore it. Noah, N-O-A-H-B-O-U-T underscore it. This is the best tweet so far. This is the Tha we were anti, by the way. From Topic Studios and Warner Media Podcast Network, this is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kamau Bell.
And I'm Cold War reenactor Hari Kundabolu. I make empty threats and engage in proxy wars, but on Twitter.
Well, Georgia has spoken. The Reverend Raphael Warnock is headed to the Senate. He defeated Kelly Loeffler, who goes back to just being a racist WNBA owner, I guess. And the Reverend will be the first black senator from Georgia ever.
And while John Ossoff's race with David Perdue is closer and maybe headed for a recount, he also looks highly likely to be headed to D.C., giving Democrats control of the Senate by the slimmest possible margin. Warnock and Ossoff, I guess you can say the GOP is getting knock-offed. I'm a dad now.
Nah. You'd have made that joke before.
That's true.
And on Politically Reactive, we like to talk to the people who do the work defending, reviving, and expanding our democracy.
And in Georgia, Ensei Ufot is definitely one of them.
Now, most of us know Stacey Abrams and the work she does in Georgia, but Stacey has been clear that it ain't just her. Ensei is the CEO of the New Georgia Project. She was at the forefront of mobilizing the black, brown, and young voters who made Georgia a battleground state. She'll tell us what this victory feels like and why this victory means that Republicans are coming for her.
Also, another thing we like to do on the show is gloat when people we despise get what they deserve. So this might be a place to note that if John Ossoff's lead holds, Mitch McConnell is out as Senate Majority Leader. That makes him Senate Minority Leader. Which, by the way, calling Mitch McConnell a minority leader is both very satisfying and fucking hilarious.
To borrow a phrase from us, fuck Mitch McConnell.
Fuck Mitch McConnell!
And now that the Democrats may just barely control the Senate, we want to assess what that may mean for legislation, for how the Senate operates, and the upcoming bloodbath between moderates and progressives in the Democratic Party and out of the Democratic Party.
That's the stuff Ryan Grimm lives and breathes as DC bureau chief for The Intercept. We'll get his take on the new Senate and what's going to be at the forefront of the Biden agenda.
It's all coming up on Politically Reactive. Hey, Hari.
Hey, man. This isn't normally how we start shows.
So just for the listening, whenever you happen to be listening to this, it is 1:05 p.m. Pacific time, which I think means it's 9 o'clock at night on the East Coast. Is that how it works, Hari?
No, it's 4. It's 4 o'clock. Okay, we're not that. It's a big country, but it's not that big.
So we did it. We got up. We knew we wanted to be up to date on the news with what happened in Georgia with the runoff. So we scheduled an interview with Ensei Ufot and Ryan Grimm. Ensei Ufot from the New Georgia Project, Ryan Grimm from The Intercept, to talk about the election and the country and what's happening and the runoff and blah, blah, blah. And then me and Hari recorded one of our standard funny, quippy, dad-style intros to the show. And then we did all that, and we were done by 11 o'clock in the morning Pacific time. We're like, all right, Matt and everybody else, put that out there into the world. And then we turned on the news. And what happened, Hari?
We turned on the news, and we found out that there was a violent coup happening at the Capitol building. Acts of sedition.
Yes.
That you would have imagined in the 1700s or 1800s as a bunch of Trumpies, like, fucking... They broke into the Capitol. They got through security because apparently they used up all the security for the Black Lives Matters protests. Mm. So there was there wasn't enough gas to stop them or police officers or that sound cannon thing they used. No, they just
or
went
Trump
right
Trump
through.
Didn't need a Trump didn't need a photo op, so they didn't clear the way for him.
Oh no, he left his mark. We don't need a photo op for this one. He's there. He's very present. And all these protesters got through. At this point, I'm describing it, but you,
yeah, right.
Point,
yeah,
I'm sure
like
you've all seen
like,
it.
What we're saying is we turned the news and saw what you already know. That's all we're saying is that we saw that there is an open coup, violent coup being staged in America. You say sedition, I say treason. I don't know. I don't know what the legal words are.
Sedition, treason, let's cut all their heads off.
So we mean with jokes.
Yes.
So this, I just want to tell it from the standpoint of how it happened to me is that me and Melissa were here. We turned on the TV. Our kids were on lunch break from their Zoom school. So our 6-year-old and our 9-year-old are in the kitchen waiting for the grilled cheese sandwiches. I'm the best grilled cheese sandwich maker on the planet, according to them. And we had the TV on. And I said to my kids, I was like, look, just so you know, we watch a lot of news in our house. This has never happened in this country's history before. And I think that's what's important to say right now. This is not any way to sort of like, well, or who knows. And I know listeners of this show don't do this, but there will be a point, and there already is starting to be a point of just sort of like normalizing this. This has never happened in this country's history before. And this country was built on this not happening. Like it was a democracy, so we wouldn't have coups.
The White House was set on fire, I believe, in the War of 1812, but the British did that.
Yes, yes, yes.
An invading army did that. There was a civil war, yeah. But it was not fought, like, the Capitol wasn't burnt down. There wasn't this kind of invasion. This happens in other countries.
It wasn't
usually when there's invasions or coups. This doesn't happen here, but it just did.
Let's be clear, in the Civil War, the president was on the side of America.
Yeah.
Lincoln was actually, he was on America's side in the Civil War. This is a Civil War where the president is on the side of the coup, of the people who are trying to overthrow the country.
To explain how wild it is right now, they found an IED on the Capitol grounds. Mm-hmm. An IED, right? Mm-hmm. In Fallujah? No! Mm-mm. In Washington, D.C., yeah. In the U.S. Capitol, there are people that are, like these Trump protesters, who supporters who are on the floor of the Capitol, sitting in the speaker seat right now. There were people who went to Pelosi's office and took photo ops, right? So if a poor person of color was to smash in a window and take a TV, we're calling for the death penalty. But this shit happens? Mm-hmm. Are you fucking kidding me? Destroyed mm-hmm. the doors of the Capitol, stormed in. Took the floor, going to Senate offices, sitting in people's seats.
Putting feet up on
like
desks.
Like God knows what's...
Like it's a game.
What'd you say?
Putting feet up on desks.
Putting feet... Because they own the place now.
It's like, I mean, to me, it's just like they literally did it for the photo ops. They went to the places where they could get the best photo ops. They're doing it for the gram.
Which is brilliant, because that means there's enough evidence that... This is America now. This is America. Trump lost the election. Georgia, which we will discuss later in the show, was won by the Democrats. But at the end of the day, you still have to deal with this Pandora's box that's been opened. It doesn't just go away.
Yeah. Well, I was reached out in the middle of all this. I'm sure you're getting a lot of texts and stuff from people. Jessica Weitz, who's my contact at the ACLU, reached out to me, and the ACLU is right on top of this. They're making it clear that they are ready with the lawyers and the lawsuits to go when it's all said and done. They're ready now to fight for a democracy. And we were going back and forth, and it was just I said to her, and I think this has to be said by all of us who believe this. If this doesn't end with Trump in handcuffs and being prosecuted, then this is then democracy is a myth. Then America is a lie we tell ourselves. This is a sitting president who is staging a violent insurrection on his own country. This can't end with him going off to go, oh, well, anyway, shaking Joe Biden's hands at the inauguration, or not going to the inauguration at all and just going to start the Trump TV network or whatever he's going to do. This has to end with Trump being prosecuted, or else we're not learning the lessons. And I know a lot of people are afraid of that because that's going to make his base even angrier. Well, look what's happening now. The country has to make a choice about who we are right now. We have to pick a direction. We have to pick a side. This is not about, otherwise we're doing what Trump did, both sides. Trump has to end up being prosecuted for this, or else we're just sort of setting the stakes for this to happen again and again.
Fear of doing what is right and normal and accepted because a group of people might get angrier and do something, that's terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
That's what terrorism is. Mm-hmm. We're being terrorized. There's so many terrorism, sedition, like this, like the idea that when there are Black Lives Matter protests all around the country, they basically get the military involved. They have like tanks. Mm-hmm. They have like these police forces that are trained for warfare, right?
Yeah.
And this happens, and somehow I think one person might have been shot, but all these people are just rushing through. Jocelyn, my partner, was telling me she saw a video of a black cop being pushed by a crowd of white people, because apparently blue lives matter except when they're black, and then the black part overrides the blue, apparently. And pushing this black cop into a group of white cops, and when they saw the white cops, they were like, oh, all right. So this is...
I mean, this is America.
This
is not a negotiation with a reasonable side. Trump's the same guy who preaches law and order. These are the same people who say blue lives matter. They're clashing with cops in D.C. It also is about how our political leaders just refused, and throughout his entire presidency, have refused to take Trump seriously. Because anybody who has followed Trump's career before he was the president, we all saw this coming. We're not smart. We just paid attention. He has been clear. He's been openly courting sedition. He's been openly courting not respecting the law. He has not respected the law many times. He has advocated for violence. He has both sides Nazism or neo-Nazism. This is not something that came out of nowhere. And so this has to be the final wake-up call for the people who we call our political leaders in this country, for the people we vote for the people we respect, to go, if you don't do something now, if you don't make it clear that this is an illegal act, that this president is trying to overthrow his own country, and you don't prosecute him like it, then you're saying this country is a lie. That's all. It's just clear. That's all you're saying. If you refuse to step up now, then you're not worth the votes. you're not worth the democracy. You're not worth our time. And I think it's got to be clear that the same way I said to my kids, we're living through the awful parts of history right now. This has never happened before. But the only way we can try to make sure it doesn't happen again is to stand up right now. And standing up means prosecuting Donald Trump and all of his cronies and all of his cohort, and all the politicians in D.C. today who stood up to try to overthrow the election, Jim Jordan, and throwing them all out. Otherwise, it's a myth. The whole America thing, America's chapter, the book on America will come to an end. We may still call it the United States of America, but it won't mean what it used to.
I remember something you said to me, Kamau, how when an empire crumbles, it's weird because you kind of see the crumbling and then you see the end. But when you're in the middle of it, you don't always know that. Oh, I guess we're in the middle of this now. this is the middle of it. Like,
yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
This is.
Yeah.
We're in the middle of it. I think.
Rome thought it was having a few bad days.
Yeah. Yeah. just 4 or 5 bad years.
Yeah, we'll get it back. Like, you know, none of the empires are not forever. So, you know, the United States Empire is certainly, I mean, even now that this happened, our reign is the greatest country in the world or whatever that nonsense was, is over. There are many qualified, intelligent, awesome people who used to aim themselves towards the United States who will not be aiming themselves this way. And that is whether Joe Biden's the president or not. They're going to be like, that shit, that neighborhood's fucked up now. Like, we don't go there anymore. So a lot of innovation, a lot of invention, a lot of just awesomeness that this country used to sort of just sort of sweat off of us like it was no big deal. That stuff is gone. Like, so that's we are definitely at the end of this, of the United States as this greatest country in the world. If we may be able to get back to that, if that's something that's worthy to get back to, but it's done for now. But now the question is, how far will we slide into the muck?
I mean, I think this is about reinstilling. I mean, I want to say civic values, but it's beyond that. It's human decency. It's a sense of, you know, politics is not a game. This is not rooting for a side. This is people's lives. The decisions you make have real impacts, right? Mm-hmm. What I'm seeing right now, and it partly feels like, you know, a war, but it's all like just seeing the footage of them storming the Capitol. But imagine every shitty riot that happens after a sports team loses, right? Mm-hmm. Except they're sober, they're angry, and the season to them, it never ends. This is just an ongoing, like, this just feel like there's a feeling of guerrilla war that I kind of feel like, mm-hmm. unless we nip this in the bud, this is going to keep going forever.
I mean,
they're never going to stop.
A year ago, I was working on an episode of United Shades about Venezuelan refugees and immigrants in this country. And so a year and a half ago, there's a lot of footage of Venezuela on social media about how basically the country has collapsed. There's been a complete economic collapse, and people are like fighting in the streets for resources and stealing water, and the currency is worth nothing. And the guy who is the president doesn't have the power of being the president because the ex-president has the military on his side. And you see footage from Venezuela, and it's just people fighting in the streets for basic resources. And through COVID and through Trump and all this, we're not that far from that. And through the lack of a stimulus, through a $600 check, which, let's be clear, a $2,000 check once isn't doing enough for people. So through that lack of a stimulus, through COVID, through Trump, through all the dissension he has sort of invited out to the surface. I tweeted the other day, he's like kicked over the log and now all the vermin is running around. Through that, we're not that far away from some sort of, and I'm not trying to shit on Venezuela. It's a beautiful country, and I've met a lot of amazing people from there. But we're not that far away from living that, from being in that kind of life, where the people who have are just protected and sort of remove themselves from regular society. And the have-nots become a larger and larger and larger class of people and start having to fight for basic resources. I'm not trying to be an alarmist. I just, having studied that a little bit, a very little bit, we're seeing this today. Like, if this was another country and we saw these images from another country on the news tonight, we would not only be, many of us would be aghast and like, oh, we'd also judge them. We would judge them. Mm-hmm. And when I say we, I don't mean you. I don't mean the listeners of this podcast mostly. I'm talking about the people who, many people in this country, they would judge them and they would mock them and talk about how they were a banana republic and how good things they need. We would, like as we said earlier, as you said earlier, we would talk about sending troops in.
Yep.
And yet, and here we are. Here we are. So I just, you know, to hear, and I've heard some people on the media, you know, I've been watching a lot of news today with this all going down, and to hear some people in the media finally go, this is insurrection. This is treason. It's like, he's been doing this for months. He's been since he got into office, many of us said, I don't think he's going to leave even after two terms. We were talking about two terms. We've been talking about, I don't think he's going to leave. This has been coming for a long time. So a lot of you who let this go and tried to yada, yada, yada in both sides of this, even though it's too late, it's time to really put your adult pants on and really step to this and step into this moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, America is not healthy. A $600 check, that's not enough for your basic needs, but it's enough for weapons. And I think that when you're in a very poison state, like the way the country is in, violence is going to follow. People have been talking about this for decades. You know, even people who are on the right who are very rich were saying, like, this is not healthy, that this inequality actually could lead to, because like the super rich that are actually somewhat thoughtful about this, they actually are aware of, we're not going to be super rich for much longer if there are violent insurrection that ruin the economy.
Yes.
We're not going to be, this country is done. It's not out of a good, like, we need to get rid of some of this inequality because it's the right thing to do. No, because the more unequal we are, the more anger that will happen, the more people like Trump will show up. And then, you know what? We're all fucked.
Yeah.
So we've hit that point. We're in the next stage of this thing.
Yeah. And Alexander's not that great anymore. He used to be in the sun sets on the British Empire every day. Like sometimes it sets twice a day. Sometimes the sun does not come up on the British Empire. So whatever you want to think that this country is, or whatever you want to, and also again, as many people point out, we're a young country. It's not like we've been around to sort of get knocked down and get back up again. We haven't been around long enough to know what this is like. So if, you know, Greece just went through it with their economy collapsing. Like this is, we've always thought we were too good for this. We're not too good for this. And we're finding that out right now. And this is when, you know, people get measured. You get to really find out what your people are made of, what your politicians are made of. It is not too soon to be tweeting at those people, to be calling your representatives, to be telling them to stand up against this, calling your congresspeople, calling your senators. It would be great if by the time they got to their phones, their voicemails were clogged up with calls from people saying, hey, it is time for you to step up and call for the prosecution of Trump and everybody who pulled it, who's responsible for this with him. Many of those are your colleagues.
We still have a show.
Yeah, we stole a chef. It's a great conversation. It's a great conversation. So just to be clear, this conversation happened before all this. So if you understand, I'm sure if we were to get Ryan and Insei back on now, it would be a different tenor of conversation. But it is a great conversation. And also, it is also a conversation that is aware of the state of the world. So it's not like it's just about celebrating Georgia.
Right. I know we have to go, but I'm just kind of stunned. I'm continuing to watch this footage as the Capitol is just... They're everywhere. Mm-hmm. These maniacs are all over the Capitol. The colonizers are getting restless, Kamau.
Trump has apparently released a video saying, Trump addresses rioters he unleashed. It's time to go home. Well, it's so funny. Now you say that? Not this morning when they realize, wait, there's 30,000 people in the Capitol. Wait a minute. That's
Paste
not what
is out of the tube.
Yeah, no, he's trying to cover his ass. He's trying to prepare himself for, at best, a pardon, but he's trying to cover his ass. This is all on you. This is the, as Malcolm X said, the chickens have come home to roost. So with us, we've got one of the key people in the world-changing movement to mobilize black voters, brown voters, and young voters in Georgia. Insei Ufot is the CEO of the New Georgia Project, whose mission is to help Georgians register to vote and to make sure that they can exercise that right without interference.
We're also joined by Ryan Grimm, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept, which, full disclosure, is published by an affiliate of First Look Media, as is Politically Reactive. Hey, Ryan and Insei!
Welcome to Politically Reactive, Ryan Grimm from The Intercept and Insei Ufot from the New Georgia Project. Thank you for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan, this is an inside job. We both work for the same corporate overlords.
That's right.
Yeah, Insei, I just want to say we just met, a few, 2 months ago officially?
You
recorded a segment of United Shades of America, and I was like, hey, would you like to do my little podcast? And you let me know that you had heard of this little podcast before.
I had, and I more than let you know. I found out. It was like, oh, of course, absolutely. I was, because in my mind, as I was finishing my last taco, I was trying to figure out like how to say, hey, the podcast you and Hari had going. What's that all about? you looking for guests? So our timing was really good.
Yes. And I just think it's important to really be clear that like this edition of the podcast has basically been brought by, has been co-sponsored by Turning Georgia Blue. That has been the theme of this first part of the podcast, and our return is every week talking about the election, Ossoff and Warnock, and the work of the New Georgia Project and all the other activists down there. We talked to Latasha Brown. And so when we booked you for this day, I was like, I hope it's going to be a good day. I hope it will be fun.
I definitely would have canceled on y'all if we lost.
So I just want to give you your flowers because you are doing you did so much of that work. And I've been on Zoom calls with you, and you're organizing people and making big decisions. And what does it feel like right now to be in this moment where it looks like, I mean, you probably have more numbers than we have, where it looks like we got two seats. What do you think?
Yeah, we have two seats. I mean, it hasn't been called yet. So like, I'm not trying to Kornacki my way through this podcast, but there are not enough votes for Senator Perdue to hold on. The outstanding votes are in the places that have a history of not being able to get their shit together. So that includes Fulton County, which also happens to be the largest county in the state, one of the blackest counties in the state, and definitely one of the most Democratic counties in the state. So I don't see a path forward for outgoing Senator David Perdue.
Wow.
So there's that. I would also add that our teams are out in about 15 minutes. We're going to start ballot curing. Actually, we've been doing a little bit of that for the past couple of days, but from our estimates, it looks like to be about 3,500 ballots that have been rejected for a number of reasons. And Georgians have the opportunity to cure those ballots. Friday at 5 p.m. is the deadline. It looks like 70% of those ballots are Dem ballots, 30% are Republican ballots. And if, you know, we cure all of those ballots, or even if we cure half of those ballots, Dems and Republicans, then it's definitely in the bag for Ossoff, and so much so that he's out of automatic recount territory. Wow. And he can get outright.
Wow. Which is extra important because if you remember in 2008, when Al Franken won that Senate race, Republicans demanded a recount and sued for like 6 months, not because they thought they were going to win, but just to keep him out of the Senate, to keep Obama from having a 60-vote supermajority. So the longer they can keep Ossoff out of the Senate, the longer they can hold on to power. So they'll sue, you know, every day as long as they can, with no hope of winning, just because it's worth it. Every day that they can keep him out of the Senate is worth the cost of a lawsuit.
100%. And so we're going to do everything that we can. So while, you know, other people might be taking today off, might be doing their victory lap. And let's be clear, every instinct in me was to, like, do an end zone dance for people who wouldn't give us money, for people who like denied what we were building in Georgia and the power of this sort of multicultural progressive majority. Like, I definitely want to do my end zone dance, but our work is not done. And so we're curing ballots, and we will be doing so until Friday at 5.
This one is really for either of you, but if both Warnoff and Ossoff ran on the $2,000 COVID stimulus checks going to families, and Biden campaigned with them saying that if they were elective, the checks will go out immediately, that seems like an exaggeration. So if Ossoff is elected, how long are we talking about here, and what does this look like?
I mean, unless they're going to send it to every American family via Venmo, I think that was an exaggeration. Yeah. Although I will happily give President-elect Biden my Cash App. happily. But I do think that was a bit of an exaggeration. I mean, I'm not pretending to be an expert in Senate procedures, but I feel like there might be some voting.
Right.
That will happen in order to make that happen.
So I can at least pretend that since that's my beat. So it's not going to happen until I don't think it could happen until January 20th when Biden is sworn in, because you can't really count on Trump signing this thing because he's such a bitter and mercurial figure. I guess you could pass it and just see what happens.
That's such a wonderful way to phrase piece of shit.
Mercurial is a new adjective for Trump. I hadn't heard that one before.
And throw in the bitterness, and it supercharges the mercurialness.
Yes, because mercurial could be a good thing until you throw bitter in there.
So the thing is, they're gonna have to do it. The way that Biden made the promise forces their hand. I mean, he left no room for interpretation. He said, the only thing standing in the way of these $2,000 checks is Mitch McConnell. You can get him out of the way by electing John and the Reverend. And once you do, those checks go out the door immediately. Like as I said, immediately isn't going to happen, but that is a very specific time frame. Yes. That's not, we're going to work on it and eventually make it happen. So they're going to move on it as fast as possible. The question then becomes, do Republicans give them the 10 votes that they need to overcome a filibuster? Previously, there were plenty of Republican votes in the House, and there were more than 10 votes in favor of it in the Senate. I think if you put it on the floor, you would get enough Republicans that might vote for it. However, that's just a guess. If Mitch McConnell can whip all of his people back into obstruction mode, then maybe they're able to filibuster that. I think it'd be a political mistake to do it, but they could do it. The process then goes through, I won't go too far into the weeds, what's called budget reconciliation. Once a year, the Senate is allowed to use a process that cannot be filibustered. And it can be a multi-trillion dollar piece of legislation. In fact, that's the process that Trump used to do his $2 trillion tax cut. Mm. So this is not an obscure provision. It's done every year. So right in the beginning of the year, they would pass reconciliation instructions, they're called. You would include the $2,000 checks in that. And then shortly after that, you pass the legislation. But this would be a slower process because since this is their only crack at this for 2021, they would also put everything else that they wanted in there. You know, state and local aid, aid to K through 12, aid to universities, money for the post office, money for COVID relief, and also vaccine distribution. You know, that there's an enormous amount of need, trillion plus dollars worth of need. And so if Republicans block the checks, the checks would be put into that reconciliation package. The handicap with reconciliation is you can't do policy. You can't do policy that doesn't directly impact the budget. So you couldn't do a Voting Rights Act, couldn't do police reform, you couldn't protect abortion rights. You can only do things that directly impact the budget. But that's checks, that's school, that's what has a direct impact in the parliamentarian rules on whether or not it has a direct impact. You can't say, well, if we do this particular piece of legislation, it would grow the economy, and as a result of growing the economy, it would raise revenue, etc. Anyway, so that would mean you wouldn't get checks until February or March if Republicans blocked them and Democrats were forced to do it through reconciliation. But then that would be a trillion plus dollar stimulus package as well.
Are we talking about one-time checks, or are we talking about checks?
Right now what's on the table is one-time checks. And I think people are going to push for checks. and that's good, you know, because then you have outside pressure to do more. And so then they feel pressure to do more.
I mean, I don't think that there's any doubt that Georgia is sending Warnock and Ossoff to the Senate for checks, right? Like, I think that's been clear throughout the runoff, right, as we've been campaigning. I think the other thing is, we're in the middle of a housing crisis, and there is the end to the eviction moratorium that's around the corner. I mean, at the end of January, we're talking about something like 12 million American families that are facing eviction. And, you know, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of them in Georgia. And so unless something happens, a $2,000 check that may come in March is not going to be able to stem the tide of this crisis that's impending.
Based on how both of you said the word checks, I'm assuming Ryan hopes we get 4 to 6 checks and say hopes we get 8 to 10 checks based on the length of the word check.
Right. It would be nice if the parties got into a regular bidding war over who could do more and bigger checks. Like, imagine that if the two parties competed for who could make your life better. Right. What an interesting system.
I like this. Say more about it.
I never understood why the Republicans had such a hard time giving people. It seems like that's going to win you over to a population by giving them money, even though it's money that's rightfully theirs. Like, that seems like, oh, they're giving money away. Like, how would you not support that?
I'm shocked that you don't understand that, given how familiar you are with petty. Right? Petty as a principle, as an operating principle, right?
I love petty, right? I do.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it is, right? It's so funny. Literally. And Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue voted for it because obviously that was the position that Trump had taken in opposition to Mitch McConnell and his party. Mitch McConnell is opposing it. And here's what's rich. And like they do not lack audacity. like your boy is full of gall. I think that the reason that he offered for rejecting it, the $2,000 checks, was that he didn't want it to be giveaways to Joe Biden's rich friends, his wealthy friends, that that's what the $2,000 aid package was going to be. And he refused to be a part of that. Right. So I think, you know, the party of no, being contrarian, being petty, is something that they're really good at.
Ryan, you brought up the Voting Rights Act. Can we talk about, since that can't be put into this reconciliation, what is the path forward for that?
So it would have so first of all, there's Warnock and Ossoff both ran heavily on this. Ossoff started calling for a new Civil Rights Act in the summer. And interestingly, like right after I broke that audio of Joe Biden telling all the civil rights leaders, hey, let's not talk about police until after Georgia. Like the next day, Ossoff was out talking about police reform and tweeting about his new Civil Rights Act. So he was like, thanks, Joe. We're running our own kind of race down here.
And, you know, I don't know if you know I'm running in Georgia.
Yeah. And his team, you know, makes the argument that they and Warnock represent kind of a new Southern Democrat, like a very new breed of Southern Democrat, which they describe sort of as civil rights populists, you know, where they're leading with their economic populism, where checks for everybody, we're going to make everybody's life better, but they're unapologetically in favor of civil rights, which is just a completely different kind of Democrat that used to run in the South. That Democrat was like, you know, was socially conservative and also economically conservative, fiscally conservative. They were just, they'd say, you know, I'll work with Trump, you know, where I agree with him. And when he's wrong for Georgia, you know, I'll fight him. And that was the most you were going to, well, what does that mean? What does any of that mean? You're just like not quite a Republican.
That was Ossoff in 2017.
Yes, that was Ossoff in 2017, running in at that point, 20, R plus 20, a huge Republican district that was fast moving. And then Lucy McBath, you know, ends up winning it the next two times. Right. And so when he then ran statewide, he changed his tune and started talking like a civil rights populist Democrat. And so they have a mandate for this from Georgia. The House has a bill called H.R. 1, which has a lot of election reform into it. That has some significant voting implications. Also, the version that passed 2 years ago is practically radical. Like it would match contributions made to candidates 6-1, up to like $250 or something. So it would transform campaign financing if it actually became law. The House Democrats, I think, were able to pass it because they knew it wouldn't pass in the Senate. It'd be interesting to see if they can get the votes together for that. Because if all of a sudden all you have to do is, you know, raise small amounts of money, then all House Democrats can move to a small dollar model rather than just the most famous ones who have big Twitter followings. So the House should be able to pass a Voting Rights Act. And the question then becomes, can they get it through the Senate? And what they're going to be doing in the first couple of months is pushing popular agenda items up against the wall of a Republican filibuster and trying to convince the Democratic holdouts who still support a filibuster that, look, we're not going to be able to get anything done, period, with these Republicans filibustering everything. And Joe Biden's one of these holdouts, one of these guys who has this magical thinking that they're going to break, the fever's going to break, and all of a sudden Republicans are going to join together with them. And right after they get done failing to overturn the election, they're going to sit down and work with them on
what bipartisan. What were we thinking? Wow, we almost staged a coup. Wow, that was a crazy.
Let's sit down summer. And hash out a deal. Yeah, like in most countries, you're in prison after you fail to do that. So the question would be: can you convince the holdouts, the Chris Coons from Delaware, Joe Manchin from West Virginia, the people who oppose getting rid of the filibuster or reforming the filibuster, that nothing's ever going to happen? Or can Republicans kind of run out the clock close enough to the midterm to the point where they say, you know what, we didn't blow up the filibuster yet. We didn't get anything done. Let's just go into the midterms and, you know, reconvene back in 2023.
Inse, you talked about how voter suppression is far from over, even with the results of the Georgia runoffs. There's still a lot of work to be done. Can you tell us what work still needs to be done in terms of voter suppression, as well as what does restoring the Voting Rights Act do to that end and for democracy in general?
Yeah, I mean, just really quickly. So Shelby versus Holders, the Supreme Court case that basically, you know, it kicked the teeth out of the Voting Rights Act. Let's just keep it a book. and specifically sections 4 and 5, which, you know, preclearance basically says, if you have a history of being shitty to Black people and making it difficult for people to vote, if you want to change any of your voting laws, you need to get permission from the Department of Justice or from a federal judge. And that was a way sort of to add some checks and balances, a speed bump, if you will, on the road to making it more difficult for people to vote. And so that feels like an easy fix to like have preclearance restored and to have it apply to more jurisdictions, if not to the entire country. And we absolutely are going to be in a fight. I want to be clear, while the rest of the country and certainly like your colleagues in the media were trying to get us to say nice things about Brad Raffensperger, Georgia Secretary of State, because he refused to participate in a criminal conspiracy to steal the election. And because like he obviously went to middle school and knows how to go and tell the whole class what you guys talked about on three-way. I mean, he's enemy of democracy. he's an enemy of voting rights. The reason that these two victories are so remarkable in Georgia is not only because we basically are going to hit 90% of the turnout from the general election, which is unheard of in a runoff. And it's certainly unheard of in a runoff that spanned Thanksgiving, Christmas, Hanukkah, mm-hmm. New Year's, and Festivus, right?
And Kwanzaa.
And Kwanzaa. My black card's still here. yes, absolutely. So unheard of. But we did it in the middle of a pandemic. And we did it when they cut the number of early voting days. They cut the number of early voting locations, like in some key battleground counties like Cobb County, which is the North Atlanta suburbs. They cut over half of the polling locations where people were able to vote. They cut the number of drop boxes where people could just drop off their completed ballots. And they put out, you know, guidance saying that they would criminally charge and prosecute any individual or organizations like ours who provided comfort to voters. So water, pizza, coffee, all of the things that we do to bring comfort to voters who are standing in long lines, we were going to get charged for it. So, and then tons of disinformation, right? You have the president coming saying that he actually won the election. People sort of rabid who have bought into this Republican fan fiction, death threats, bomb threats at polling locations. Like, that is the context in which Reverend Warnock and Ossoff won, right? And so the power of what we're building is undeniable. They threw everything at us and they were still unsuccessful. They're coming for us. So Brad Raffensperger came down to the legislature and said, we're gonna get rid of absentee, no-fault early voting in the state. Now, you should know that a lot of states moved to vote by mail in the middle of the pandemic as a way to sort of manage their citizens' exposure to the virus. Georgia has had vote by mail, no fault absentee balloting for the better part of a decade. It was a Republican policy initiative. It was the way that Republicans have been voting for, again, the better part of a decade in Georgia. And now that they've lost, they want to attack the entire institution, take their ball and go home. So they've communicated this as their priority going into the legislative session that starts up in a couple of days. It's disgusting.
Yeah. And which is aimed at Warnock, because he's up. In, like, Warnock is already running for re-election because he's filling the basically Johnny Isaacson retired. He was sick, replaced by Loeffler. And so he's filling out Isaacson's term, which ends in 2022. So Warnock, they're already trying to gun for Warnock.
So just to go back, so to think of, instead of thinking of Brad Raffensperger as a hero, he's basically like Henry Hill in Goodfellas, where at the very last minute, he's like, I'm telling. the last minute, he's turning state's evidence.
You're just completely motivated by self-interest. He said it. He said, I'm not going to release the tape unless Trump attacks me. And then Trump does what Trump does. And he went to Twitter and called him a whiny little. And then he released the tape. So I don't think that he was motivated by sort of this duty to state and country and to our democracy. The big bad president was mean to him. And so he released their pre-recorded conversation.
So you say they're coming for us. What does that mean in practice? What does that mean for you and the team you work with?
Well, so Raffensperger and co already launched an investigation into us a couple of days after the November general election, accusing us of voter registration fraud. In Georgia, it carries with it a penalty of up to 10 years in prison and $100,000 in fines for each form. Now, I feel very confident that the program that we run employs best practices. We're very aggressive in our training. And so the charges are nonsense, but they're designed to have a chilling effect. And so despite the fact that the charges and the allegations are fake, the money that we have to spend on lawyers to defend ourselves is very real. And so it's a tactic that the right has used to drain us of our resources, to distract us from doing the work that we've been doing, and to cast this sort of a pall over the work of the New Georgia Project and groups like ours. And so again, they're baseless allegations. They're not real, but we are going to have to defend ourselves against them. And we believe that this is just the beginning, because this feels like the only move that they have left.
There's so much historical precedent here. There's this asymmetry between the right and the left on this question of attacking the power centers of the opposition. You know, Republicans very deliberately went after Acorn because not only was it registering voters, but it was making people's lives better, doing, you know, housing rights advocacy. And it was demonstrating to communities that if you participate in the political process, you can improve your material circumstances. And so you have to attack that. Planned Parenthood, it fits with their kind of 40-year, you know, anti-abortion, like right-wing crusade, but also Planned Parenthood is the same thing. It shows you that if you participate in your community in a democratic way, you can improve your material circumstances. You can get access to healthcare, you know, whether you can afford it or not. And so they go after Planned Parenthood to try to destroy them.
Organized labor.
Democrats don't do the same to Republican sources of power. Democrats, when they had an opportunity after the 2008 financial crisis to prosecute Wall Street, you know, which would have, you know, gutted and disempowered the political strength of that entity, passed. You know, forget it. And so that was wrong on a number of levels, but it was also wrong just, you know, tactically in combat with the opposition party. The right wing doesn't make that same mistake. They look at groups that are effective at improving the lives of other people and in getting Democrats elected. And they bring to bear the criminal law and do everything they can to try to destroy them.
That feeds perfectly into to my next question, because the Democrats now have the Senate, the House, and the presidency. So I think here's a question that every progressive has. Ryan, how can the Democrats fuck this up? and that's me being optimistic, because I said can, not are.
Right. No, yeah. No, at least you're leaving open the possibility that they might not, which is more than a lot of people are willing to give them the credit for. I mean, the way they fuck it up is the way they fucked it up in 2009 on a couple of different levels. One was going too small mm-hmm. on the initial stimulus. Now, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, they both recognize that was a huge mistake. You got to shoot too high rather than too low. They shot too low. They went into the November midterms with 10% plus unemployment. Now, that was absolutely killer. They also have to make sure that people feel the benefits of what they're doing right away. When they did the Affordable Care Act, they got so cute. They're like, this isn't going to cost anything. It's going to be $1 trillion, but it's going to reduce the deficit because we're going to bend the cost curve. And they tried to make this moral crusade to bring everybody health care just all about bending the cost curve on the deficit. And in order to make that work, what they did is they gauge federal spending in a 10-year time frame, 10-year window. So what they said is, well, if we don't have the benefits of the ACA kick in until like 5 years down the road, then it sort of like costs us half the amount, which was a game, because in the second 10 years, it's going to cost the full amount.
Right.
But they're like, well, we can keep it under $1 trillion, which was this magic number in their head. And so you have this 14-month process where everybody's frightened about what's going to happen to the healthcare system. It passes this contentious vote, and then nobody feels anything for years until 2014, 15, finally the subsidies start rolling in. Eventually you get the Medicaid expansion. You know, the court tries to strike it down, so then the state legislatures have to expand it. It's not really until 5 years later that people are starting to actually feel some of the benefits, most of which came through the Medicaid expansion of the Affordable Care Act. And by then they'd lost the House and they'd suffered all of these other political repercussions. So Democrats, if they do something big, they've got to make sure people feel it right away and like it. And then it will stick around. And that's kind of the evidence of the Affordable Care Act. They have not, even though it's kind of crappy, like they haven't been able to repeal it, because it's hard to take something away from somebody once they have it. So give it to people quicker. Don't get cute and think. And I'll never forgive them for this idiocy around the stimulus. They wanted to make sure that, again, it was this low number just for political purposes. There was, if the $700 billion Wall Street bailout was then followed by a roughly $700 billion stimulus, which they made in that range to be clever. So it was less than $1 trillion, and then people wouldn't get shocked. You know, they wouldn't get sticker shock. But then, because they both started with a seven, everybody just lumped the stimulus and the Wall Street bailout together and blamed mm-hmm. Democrats for the Wall Street bailout. So it's like, idiots, even when you're trying to get clever, you're not being smart. So instead of trying to be clever, just do the right thing. Just like help as many people as you can, as fast as you can, and then hope that you get rewarded for that.
I think the thing, so this reminds me that one of the things that I've been thinking about in this moment is that, like, when even when Republicans lose, they act like they have a mandate.
Yes. Yes.
And when Democrats win, they never act like they have a mandate, right? And so, like, what is it that we can do from the grassroots to make sure that Democrats know that they have a mandate and that they get to DC and act like they have one and get bullish on the things that that all of the data, all of the polling, all of the focus groups show that the American people clearly want, right? Like, why are we negotiating against ourselves? I don't know what that instinct is, but we want to organize around it. Like, I want to cut it out like the cancer that it is. So,
yeah. And one of the nice things is that in Georgia, they did not run on restoring dignity. and the vague things that the Democrats kind of ran on in the general election. And that, so Joe Biden could take from
battling
the general election.
The soul of America.
By the soul of America. Yeah.
Is that a policy proposition? Yeah.
The Soul of America Act. So, you know, that was Joe Biden's takeaway from, and if you listen to his call with the civil rights leaders.
Let's get something straight. You shouldn't be disappointed. What I've done so far is more than anybody else has done this far. Okay?
He's like, what do you want from me? I said Charlottesville's bad. Like, I took on this racist guy. I'm restoring the soul of the nation. The words
I'm literally
of the president
not Donald Trump. So
I'm
you
not
can't
Donald
be, I'm
Trump. Not, yeah. We stop complaining. God. And so if not for Georgia, that could have been the takeaway for him and for Democrats that this is enough. We got rid of Trump. We restored the soul of the nation. But that's not what they ran on in Georgia, including Biden. You know, Biden himself saying, you elect John and the Reverend, you get $2,000 checks and you will get help immediately to people. So what he needs to understand is that's what people voted for. So that's what you need to do. If you want to restore the soul of the nation, go ahead. Fine.
White guy restoring soul. Get the fuck out of here.
He's the Justin Timberlake of friends. Is that too much insight?
Listen, he's from Tennessee. I'll take it. Okay.
So there's another thing that's been happening sort of like as a lot of us were talking about Georgia and focusing on the runoff. There was a lot on Twitter about this, about Nancy Pelosi being elected Speaker of the House again. And progressives, some versions of the progressives suddenly getting mad at the Squad, saying that they shouldn't vote for Nancy Pelosi. The Squad did vote for Nancy Pelosi. And there's just sort of this idea that even if there sort of seems like even if we go forward with the president, the Senate, and the Congress, that there is progressives who are now not happy with the progressives who've been elected. And how that's and start it's starting to get ugly. I don't know if you've all paid attention to the hashtag force to vote. It's hard to avoid. But what are your thoughts on any of that?
I mean, regrettably, I jumped into that fairly early on to try to tamp down all this anger around and this push around this force to vote, which came out like around Christmas and New Year's or so. You know, it's like this. The caucus had already voted for Nancy Pelosi to be speaker. The only thing left was the floor vote. And all of a sudden, from a YouTube personality, that comes this idea that you should withhold your vote for Pelosi in order to force a floor vote on Medicare for All. It's like, okay, that's fine if a YouTube media personality has an idea. But all of a sudden, it became this like litmus test that if you don't agree with this person's particular tactic, immediately and execute it, then you don't actually want Medicare for All and you actually would prefer that people just start dying or just continue to die and probably die at a greater rate. It ignored the fact that there is an entire constellation of organizations that have been fighting for Medicare for All for a long time to get it to where it is. And none of them wanted this to be the strategy. Like not a single one. National Nurses United was basically formed to fight for Medicare for All. It's the largest nurses union in the country. They don't support that. I actually interviewed their political director for my own podcast that'll be out later this week. They're like, that's not smart. Like, they have 118 co-sponsors on Medicare for All. There's 435 people in Congress. So your vote, the vote would end up being something like, you know, 320 to 115. You want to lose by more than 200 votes for what? So that you can find out who doesn't support it and then primary them? Well, we know who doesn't support it. All the people that haven't co-sponsored haven't supported it. So there are arguments. You can make arguments on both sides. I could make an argument that it could be a nice organizing tool to say, look, we're going to have a vote in December of 2021. Between now and then, we're going to have hearings and we're going to lobby members of Congress in every single district in the country, and then we're going to put them on record. Fine. Like, you can argue at both sides, but the idea that people who disagreed with the tactic were shills and sellouts was, I think, specifically designed by some of the organizers to sow cynicism so that they could platform this third party that they're trying to produce. Like, one or two of the like lead organizers of this thing is trying to start this third party movement for a people's party. And so in order to start the third party, you know, you have to convince people that Democrats are completely useless. Like, the squad is not the thing that is standing in the way of Medicare for all, but the squad is standing in the way of their ability to create a third party out of the energy that they're kind of absorbing into the Democratic Party. So they resent the fact that people have hope in the Democratic Party. So, and I even watched one of their town halls, and the guy says at the end, he's like, when this fails, you know, all the energy needs to go into our third party. He's like, well, if this fails, like they knew off the bat that they were just setting up something that was going to fall apart so that they could say that, look, see, we told you they're all sellouts. Right. Let's form a new party.
I mean, I'll say this. I think that America is far too large. There are far too many of us for just two parties, two major political parties. And I'm also not willing to set fire to the world. I come from vulnerable communities. Some people just really want to watch the world burn, mm-hmm. right? And so when I think about, you know, what is at stake for women and femmes and poor folks and queer people in the deep South who are like fighting for our lives in this particular moment. Again, I'm just not particularly interested in watching the world burn. And ultimately, as an organizer, I have found that building a bigger we comes from like getting people to buy into your theory of change, getting people to sort of agree with your analysis about how to bring about that change, not, you know, these sort of divisive politics and these, like, again, just politics of division. We want to build the bigger we, and this new third party, if you're going to build your house, you're going to build your party, you're going to build your movement on like trying to trash sort of the leaders that we have. I don't know if that's a winning play.
Well, that's what was in my Twitter draft thing, but I couldn't get it out that way. So thank you for saying it. Right. Say.
I wonder, I'm curious what you guys think. Should we, everybody have just ignored it? I mean, was fighting it a mistake? Was trying to make these points on Twitter, which is not a place where you can express nuance. Was it a mistake because that amplified the heat around it? Or do you have to fight this stuff? Otherwise, the cynicism just continues to like seep everywhere. And I don't actually know the answer to that.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I know this is probably gonna sound like a cop out to some of you, but I did ignore it. But I also, we had three.
You were working.
You were doing stuff.
Right.
I mean, I ignored it too, but for similar reasons. One, I think it is important for some people who have the time to sort of engage with that to engage with it. But I think there was an element of shame that was around it, that if you're not engaging with it, you don't care about people dying. Mm-hmm. And that's the part I felt like I was like, I consider myself to be working under General Insay. So I was like, no, I'm already doing some things. I'm already also I got three kids and it's the holidays. But I do think that it did sort of expose, it made things clearer around some people that I think is important around what people's tactics are, what they're willing to do to win. And for me, that's better to know as we go forward. So that's how I feel about it. But I also know that Insay's got to go because she's got important things to do and I don't want to hold her anymore. Ryan, I'm sure you got to go because you got important things to do. So I just want to say thank you both for being on the podcast today. We appreciate it. Please come back again.
I would love to. I promise. I do not sound like this normally. I've been in campaign mode and I haven't been getting much sleep. And so that's why I sound like a cartoon villain. but I promise. come back. You'll get my regular voice.
That's right. Well, thanks, Bane. We appreciate having you on
here. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Ryan Grimm is the DC bureau chief for The Intercept. You can read his reporting at theintercept.com. You can also check out his excellent podcast, Deconstructed.
Insay Ufot is CEO of the New Georgia Project. And while the Senate runoff in Georgia is over, the work of the New Georgia Project certainly ain't. You can keep up on their efforts to defend and expand the right to vote and give your support at newgeorgiaproject.org. That's newgeorgiaproject.org. That's it for this week. We definitely want to hear your reaction to the Georgia runoff and your hopes and demands for a Democratic-led Senate.
Leave us a message at 917-477-6525.
917-477-6525.
Or react on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Friendster, Snapchat, AOL Instant Message. Did I miss any?
No. Use the hashtag politically reactive. Hashtag politically reactive. Politically Reactive is a production of Topic Studios and Warner Media Podcast Network. Executive producers are Maria Zuckerman and Christy Gressman.
And my esteemed colleague, W. Kamau Bell.
And my colleague, Hari Kondabolu.
What the fuck? If you'd like to hear more of me and Kamau's work, you can see our Netflix specials, Warn Your Relatives and Private School Negro, of course, on Netflix. And also my brother and I have a podcast called the Untitled Kondabolu Brothers Podcast, which we call Seasonal and Small Batch because there have been 31 episodes over the course of a decade, and we don't know when they're going to pop up. So there you go.
The show is produced by Matt Martin, Kelly Rafferty, and Malachi Seeger-Sakir. Will Stanton engineers and mixes the show. And thanks, as always, to Brontez Purnell for providing music for the show. Thanks for listening to Politically Reactive.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.